Cold mornings, frosty windows. Yep, it's that time of year. So treat yourself and start your day with a cup of fresh roasted Sterling Roastery coffee, sourced from around the world and roasted multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. It's the kind of warm-up every sports fan deserves this holiday season. And right now, you can win one of three $50 Sterling gift cards, perfect for gifting or building your own winning lineup of Java in the morning. Enter today at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways so you can wake up, warm up, and Sterling up this holiday season. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
125 defining moments, one legendary league. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and a great book is out right now, NFL Moments, 125 Icons and Stories That Define the NFL. It's a definitive visual history of the National Football League, packed with iconic images and untold stories behind the game's biggest plays and its greatest players. From the early legends like Red Grange to today's stars like Patrick Mahomes, this book is a touchdown for fans who crave more than just stories. So give your football bookshelf a Hall of Fame upgrade or snag a holiday gift for that NFL history buff on your shopping list. Pick up NFL Moments, available now at your favorite bookseller.
Hey, this is Mike Hollis, former kicker for the Jacksonville Jaguars, Buffalo Bills, and New York Giants, and you're listening to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on Sports History Network.
Welcome to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. I'm your host, Ken Crippen, and I'm the founder and lead instructor at the Football Learning Academy, an online school teaching pro football history. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. Today's special guest is one of the greatest returners in NFL history, Rick Upchurch. Drafted by the Denver Broncos in the fourth round of the 1975 NFL Draft, he is one of the few people who have been named to two all-decade teams. He led the league three times in punt yards per return and in punt returns for touchdowns. He was named to four Pro Bowls and has been inducted into the Denver Broncos Ring of Fame and was named to the Denver Broncos 50th anniversary team. He is currently ranked 11th all-time in punt return yards for a career. When he retired, he was first all-time ahead of Billy White Shoes Johnson. Now let's get to our interview with Rick Upchurch. I'd like to welcome Denver Broncos great Rick Upchurch to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. How are you doing today, Rick?
I am doing wonderful. And yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. So let's start with your current Denver Broncos franchise. What are your thoughts on the team so far this season?
I like what they're doing. I like the process of Bo Nix, man, coming around and starting to show why he was the number one draft pick for the Denver Broncos. And I like the way he is. I mean, I had John Elway, you know, his first year. And once again, we knew that John certainly had some great potential to be a great quarterback. And, you know, he's a Hall of Fame quarterback now. And I look at Bo Nix the same way. Once again, him getting indoctrinated into Sean Payton's offensive scheme and that whole deal and getting used to the receivers and getting a good running game and a good offensive line for him. I think the Broncos are going to be great, and I think the defense is deep. I think they'll match up with anybody in the National Football League. And on special teams, you got Marvin Mims and that special teams that's doing a great job. I think all the way around, they're doing a great job this year.
Yeah, they got a pretty tough division with Kansas City and Los Angeles in there as well.
Absolutely, but I think they feel good about themselves right now this year. I feel like last year when they beat Kansas City and it gave them some, you know, hey guys, we can beat these guys, no problem. We just cut out the mistakes. And even with the Chargers, I believe they're feeling good about themselves, I think, right now. And everything is starting to come together at the right time. And yes, it's a tough division, but I think the Broncos, I think they're going to going to hit that division up, that Western division up.
Now, what does it mean to be a Denver Bronco, and how do you stay connected with the organization today and its fans?
What does it mean to be a Denver Bronco? Let me tell you, it means everything to me. I played my whole career in Denver, my whole 9 years. So, yeah, I'm a homesteader. And so I didn't play for any other team. And, you know, I take it serious when they're playing. And I want nothing but success for them. I think with the Penner Group taking over, I think bringing in, you know, a new fresh start for the Denver Bronco football team, all the things that they're doing, you know, with the new training center and looking at building a new stadium. I think it's refreshing to everyone in Bronco land that the Penner Group has come in and made some great differences for the team and, you know, for the fans there.
Now, you were just at an alumni event, correct?
I was, yeah. The alumni weekend was great. The great Demaryius Thomas was inducted into the Denver Broncos Ring of Fame. And, you know, the 50 Super Bowl 50 team came back as well, and they celebrated them as well and had a chance to spend some quality time with all of those guys and Demaryius' family. It was a great time.
All right, let's start with your history. So you're one of 10 children. What was it like, life like growing up for you?
Well, I was the oldest boy, and the thing about it is, for me, I was raised by my grandparents. Day one, when I came home from the hospital, my grandfather said, and I'm taking him home with me. And so my grandfather raised me. He raised me, you know, to put my hands on things. I was raised on a farm. We had chickens. We had ducks. We had pigs. We had all of those things on the farm. We had a great garden. And we learned how to, you know, manage those things. We were out in the garden and made sure that the weeds weren't growing up in there. And we had to go out and harvest them. And once again, with the pigs and the ducks and all of those things, we had to feed those. And so we had chores we had to do. And they made sure that we did those chores because they always told us that, hey, you know what? This is just prepping you when you get older to be able to go out and do your job.
I imagine it gave you a pretty good work ethic, knowing that you had all these chores every day that you had to do. And it was, you know, obviously it's not easy work.
No, not at all. You know, being young, you know, you just want to run around and jump around and be free. But when, you know, your grandparents say, hey, man, this is what's got to be done, you do it.
Mm-hmm. When did you start playing football?
Oh, I started football back when I was about 5-6 years old out in the yard with my brothers and my cousins and family members and neighborhood, you know, folks. We were out in the yard all the time, just playing and jumping and flipping and passing and running. And we had all that yard to do it in. So I started like I was 5 or 6.
Now, when you started playing organized football, you were a running back, correct?
I was a running back, kick returner. I you know, I was a receiver. I mean, I did them all. I was a Swiss knife. And so sometimes they would throw the ball to me out of the backfield or put me into the slot and throw the ball to me because I was really, really fast. And they were like, dang on, dude, you're this little and you can run that fast. I'm like, yep, absolutely, man. I don't want to get hurt.
Now, outside of football, what other sports did you do in high school?
I did basketball, baseball. I was track. I was a state champion in the long jump in track. And so I did all of them, basketball. I was on the basketball team, and I was really good on defense because they always put me on their best ball player for defense. And so, yeah, and I love golf. Golf was another sport that I really, really loved. But I never got into it. I did caddying at our golf course that right down the road from us. Let me tell you, basketball, baseball, football, and track were my thing.
Okay. Now, I'm guessing that, you know, playing in all of those different types of sports added to your overall skill set. I mean, do you recommend that if somebody wants to, even if they want to focus on football, that they go to these other sports in order to build up additional skills?
Absolutely. You don't want to be a football player. Like I said, you want to be a Swiss knife where, hey, coach, put me in, right? You don't want to be over on the bench. And if all you've been doing is just playing football instead of, you know, playing some basketball to help you with your skills, back and forth, sideways, those type of things, running track to improve on your speed, all of those type of things. Once again, it's all about you and your body and connecting so that then when you go out, you say, I can do anything. I can play any sport. Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
Now, talk to me about your journey going to Indian Hills Community College.
Well, you know, in high school, my junior year was my senior year. When my grandmother passed away, I went into a real depression. And so in the sixth grade, they held me back. I was very hurt. I just didn't do anything. And so my junior year was my senior year. So that senior year, the coach says, well, Rick's got to stay involved in something. We don't want him to get caught up in it, you know, to any problems or, you know, or any of those type of things. And so the head coach, football coach, his name was Walt Martitius. He called a couple of people from Purdue University. They recommended Al Daniels at Indian Hills Community College. You know, they sent film to Al, and Al saw the film and says, we'll take him. And so the next thing I know, I'm on an airplane. I passed my GED test. And when I passed my GED test, they said, well, Rick, you're going to Indian Hills Community College. I had no idea where I was going. I got on the plane, and that was that. And so got there, and I was like, wow, this is Centerville, Iowa. It wasn't much, but let me tell you, when I got there, the community was loving, they were caring, and the guys that I played with, we're still friends today. We won the very first and only junior college championship there at Indian Hills Community College. The last game that we played, we won 35-0 against the number 4 team in the country. So, yeah, we brought that that championship breed to Indian Hills Community College, and that was that. I mean, we're still friends today, all of us. All of us are still good friends.
That's great. Now, you go from Indian Hills to the University of Minnesota. So, one, why Minnesota? And two is, were there other schools that were also interested in you?
Absolutely. I was a two-time All-American coming out of Indian Hills Community College. And one of the top running backs, one of the top three running backs in the country. And so when I went to the University of Minnesota, you know, we ran that Veer offense up there. And I said to myself, man, this is a great place for me to be. Now, I went to Nebraska. I visited Nebraska. I visited Florida, those teams. But I just felt good about the University of Minnesota. And so I chose University of Minnesota, and boy, it worked out for me. Tony Dungy was my quarterback my senior year, and we had a doggone good team. And we brought that program back as well. My first year there, we went 7-4, and we went 6-2 in the Big Ten. That put us in third place behind, naturally, Michigan and Ohio State. And so, we had a great time there, Minnesota. I love Minnesota. I love it up there, the 10,000 lakes. The people were great. Coaches were great. Cal Stahl and all the coaching staff were absolutely great. And let me tell you something. When I got there, I it was cold, right? And I said to myself, oh, man, did I make a mistake? It was freezing, especially when you had to play Wisconsin, you know, the last year, the last game of the year. And you're saying to yourself, can I stand it? But you know what? It all worked out. And I'm so happy that I went there to the University of Minnesota. I was a two-time All-Big Ten performer for the Gophers as well.
So once you got to Minnesota, you started playing wide receiver and special teams, correct?
No, I was always. Even at Indian Hills, they were throwing the ball to me. I'd be putting me in the slot, throwing the ball to me, getting me one-on-one with linebackers, which was deadly. And so that's what they did there at the University of Minnesota. We ran the Veer, but also they would throw the ball to me out of the backfield, get me one-on-one with linebackers.
Now, you had mentioned Tony Dungy. Do you still keep in touch with him?
Not as much because Tony, you know, he's doing this TV thing and all of that. So I'm not in contact with him. But when we do our Zoom calls, we have our Gopher family Zoom calls that we do. And so I always tell the guys to tell Tony if they see him, tell him I said hello.
All right. Now, talk to me about getting drafted by the Denver Broncos. And were there any other teams that expressed interest in you?
Well, no, I didn't get anything from anyone. I thought Minnesota was probably going to take me because that's where I played. Right. But I was looking at Kansas City or Pittsburgh. Those were my two teams. And I remember on draft day, we were all walking, sitting around and, you know, playing cards and that. And then the phone call came and they said, Rick, this is the Denver Broncos and you're coming to the Mile High City. And I said, Mile High City, Denver Broncos, who is that? And so Tony Dungy runs in, he grabs a map and he said, Denver, where is Denver at? And so he's there, he's looking and he's like, there's Denver right there. And I said, there's not a whole lot around. That's for sure. And so, they told me that I was coming to Denver and got on the plane, flew in, saw those mountains, a lot of snow on them. And they said that snow will be gone quickly. I said, yeah, right. You know, I've been up in Minnesota and snow would hang around until around May, you know, or June or something of that nature. But that next day, the snow was gone. And they said, this is a beautiful place to be, Rick. We're glad to have you. And had a chance to meet everyone. John Ralston drafted me. And that was that. Now, I played in the Hula Bowl. And that definitely gave me an opportunity and a chance to show that I could play against, you know, other teams and some of the best in the country. And so once they saw me on film at the Hula Bowl, that's when they said, we're going to take this kid. Hmm.
Did you always think that you would be able to play in the NFL?
You know, it was a question. I mean, you know, you don't know until you get there. You know, playing in the Big Ten is like playing in the National Football League. You know, I played against the great Randy Gradishar and a whole bunch of other great ball players in the Big Ten. So I felt like if I could play in the Big Ten, I could, you know, handle it there in the National Football League, but not as a running back. I said, I can catch the ball and I can return kicks. If I can just catch on there, I'll learn how to, you know, play wide receiver and sitting down in zones and my speed and all of those type of things and that whole deal. And so that's what they told me. They says, Rick, you won't last, you know, in the National Football League, but what we're going to do is we're going to make you a wide receiver. And what you have to do is just learn. Mm-hmm.
Now, what was it like playing in that altitude? You talked about Mile High City. I know it wears people down a lot faster. Tell me about your experiences playing in that altitude.
Well, let me tell you, when I first got there and I took off running because I called myself, you know, training for the altitude, I almost called a doggone cab so that I could get back home. I mean, that thin air, boy, it was making you huff and puff, that's for sure. And it was certainly an advantage, let me tell you, because what happens is the air is so thin, you have to breathe deep in order to oxygenate your body, right? And so if your lungs aren't used to that, you can't take in enough air and that whole deal. So you start hyperventilating, right? Mm-hmm. And so when teams would come in from altitude, we were like fourth quarter's ours. That's what and they would be over there. We saw some guys over there on the other team fighting over the doggone mask for oxygen. So
so I was watching some of your game film and your first game, you had your welcome to the NFL moment where you were hit so hard on that opening kickoff that it cracked your helmet. So talk to me about that experience, but that you still came back and you racked up 284 all-purpose yards. So what was that first game like for you?
Well, you know, again, the great Floyd Little, I remember walking out and I'm saying to myself, oh, I'm in the National Football League. Oh, my goodness. This is my first game. I was a little nervous, right? But on the same, I was excited. I was like, man, I've made it. I've gotten here to the National Football League. I got to hold on to this. And so I remember we walked out on the field. I walked out there with the great Floyd Little. And he said, Rook, are you ready? I said, I'm as ready as I'm going to be for it, that's for sure. And I remember before the kickoff, the whole crowd in the stadium, they turned over these orange cards and the whole place went orange. I mean, it lit up the place. And I mean, it was the yelling and stuff. And I was like, oh my gosh, I got, you know, bumps on my arms and the whole works. And Jan Stenerud kicks the ball off. It starts over to Floyd. And I said, Floyd, it's your ball. It's your ball. Floyd said, I got it. I got it. And so I run up. And then the ball starts hooking towards me because Jan Stenerud had that type of a kick. Mm-hmm. And so I'm standing there and I'm like, uh-oh, the ball's coming to me. And Floyd says, the ball's coming to you, 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 you. And I said, oh, yeah, me, me, me. And so I catch the ball and I see the goalpost. I mean, when I catch it, I look down. I'm like, oh, look at that hole. My first time I touch it. And I turned on the jets and it closed, man. And I got jacked up. My helmet went sideways. I was looking through the ear hole. My lip got busted. My eye had a knot over the top of it. My helmet was cracked. It was a bad wreck, bro. Believe me. They said, welcome to the NFL. So I get over to the sideline and they give me, you know, the smelling salts. And how many fingers is it? I told them that. I said, well, how come these pink elephants are in front of me? They're like, you got knocked out. That's why. And so then, I'm backing up Haven Moses, who's a veteran. He gets hit by Jim Kearney. His face mask explodes, right? And so now they're like, Rook, you're in the game. I'm like, oh, snap. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm just learning. And so when I go in, Charlie Johnson comes to me and says, Rook, just follow me. I got you, okay? I said, okay. And, man, fright is inspirational. Let me tell you, my first pass that I caught was a 90-yard touchdown pass and that whole deal. And then I had a reverse that I took in as well. So I had two touchdowns that game as well. But I ended up with, like you said, 284 yards. I averaged 40 yards a touch each time I touched the ball. So that day let me know that I was ready for the National Football League and I could do some damage.
Yeah, definitely. So in 1977, Red Miller's coming in to coach the team. What was it like playing for him?
It was great. Love Red Miller. What a fine coach. What a fine human being. He's a gentleman that you could sit down and talk with, and he would be straight with you. And you could believe the words that were coming out of his mouth. And he was that salt and he was that pepper, man, that we needed for our football team. Remember that the year before, 1976, we went 9-5, I believe it was. 9-5. And we felt like we should have made the playoffs. And so there was a rebellion, and John Ralston was replaced by Red Miller. And Red Miller came in no nonsense. And the way we knew that he was no nonsense, he took one of our ball players, man, and, you know, Red was a wrestler. He was a leatherneck there at Western Illinois. And one of the players challenged him. And boy, he took him and put him on the ground so fast. It was unbelievable. And we said to ourselves, we got the right leader right here.
Now, in your practices, how much time did you spend on the return game, knowing that, you know, you were doing a lot of the return work?
A lot. We spent a lot of time in the film room looking at teams and where they were vulnerable and where we could possibly, you know, make a big play or get a good return. And so I spent a lot of time in the offensive room and in the special teams room, helping put together the return game for our football team.
Now, you had an amazing defense back then, that Orange Crush defense. Talk to me about practicing against that defense.
Well, I didn't practice against them because I was, you know, they didn't put me out there, man, on the scout team. Mm-hmm. But I watched them. But let me tell you something. Just absolutely outstanding football players. Lyle Alzada was the enforcer. Reuben Carter, man, held down the nose. You had Barney Chavis. You had Randy Gratishar. You had Bob Swinson. You had all of these guys, Tom Jackson, all of these guys. Louis Wright, who came in with me, was a number one draft choice. They were awesome. They didn't make any mistakes. And Joe Collier, that architect of our defense, that 3-4 defense, man, had those boys playing like premium gas that you put in your car.
Now, you were able to make it to a Super Bowl. You didn't win. You lost 27-10 to the Cowboys. So talk to me about that experience of getting to the Super Bowl and playing in it.
It was everything. It really was. It was the first opportunity. We went to the very first playoff game that the team had ever been to. First win, you know, in a playoff, and then going to the very first Super Bowl. I mean, the state of Colorado, Denver, the whole region was just going absolutely nuts. Everything was orange and blue, right? Everybody was walking around saying, you know why God loved the Broncos? Because sunsets are orange and blue. I mean, it was crazy. Kids' hair was orange. The dogs and cats, their houses, it was absolutely bedlam. And folks were just, and the good thing about it is when, Ken, it was when we brought all of our society together, all of the people were happy and they were jubilant. There was no fighting. There was no arguing. Everybody was just happy. So we had an opportunity to bring our community together and give them something that they hadn't had, but they were wishing for.
Mm. Now in 81, Dan Reeves comes in. How did he compare to Red Miller?
Dan had that Dallas Cowboy philosophy. He brought it in and we had to adapt to it. The play calling was totally different. The system was totally different. The way he coached was totally different and we had to adjust to it. So we adjusted to it and Dan was very successful, went to three Super Bowls, didn't win any of them in that whole deal, but he still took the team to three Super Bowls. And that tells you enough about who Dan Reeves was. He was a very good coach and he was a disciplined coach as well. Mm.
Now, I know you only got to play with Elway for a few years. You had talked about him earlier, but talk about playing with him as your quarterback.
Well, I played with him his rookie year. That was my last year. And let me tell you, I hadn't had anybody throw the ball that hard to me ever. And John, man, you know, baseball player in that old deal, he couldn't read the defenses. The defenses were really fast. So he had to get used to the speed of the game, right? And so in order for him to, you know, to adapt or to emphasize, man, the game, I mean, he threw that ball so hard. And instead of throwing the receivers open, he would wait for us to come open and he would lead us into the linebackers or the safeties and that type of stuff. So he had to learn. We knew the potential that this young man had was over the top, but he had to learn how to play in the National Football League. And once again, we know what happened once he caught on and got with Mike Shanahan and ended up winning two Super Bowls. And I was so very happy for him and the team and our organization for sure. John was a true leader, and he showed that. He was very, very good.
Now, it was an injury that caused you to retire, correct?
Yes, neck injury, caught a pass, came down, guys fell on me, and messed my neck up in that whole deal. And they didn't think it was a good idea for me to continue to play.
Now, I know that you had tried working out a trade to Cleveland, but those yes. doctors were saying that you should retire as well. So, I mean, it sounded yes. like you thought you had more football in you, even though that you're recovering from that injury, correct?
Absolutely. Because here's why. I remember in the spring after, you know, I came back and I had gone to my chiropractic doctor, went to therapy and that whole deal and built my neck up and was feeling good. I wasn't feeling bad at all. And so when we went through OTAs during the spring, I was out there and, you know, doing my thing, running, jumping, no problems, no issues. And then, you know, when Dan and I and the organization didn't see eye to eye, right? I wanted to trade. And so the Cleveland Browns, you know, inquired and boy, I was looking at going to Cleveland. And when they checked out my neck and looked at my neck, they said, well, Rick, you can't play anymore because you have a stenosis in that ordeal and it could probably, you know, paralyze you. And I was like, oh my goodness. Those are the worst words you want to hear, but and you always want to go out on your own terms, right, Ken? You just mm-hmm. want to go out on your own terms, but it wasn't for me to go out on my own terms, but I got 9 years in, nine great years in.
Now, after you retired from playing football, you started getting into coaching. Talk to me about your coaching career in college and high school.
Yeah, I got into it, but for the first couple of years, honestly and truthfully, I was in a bad way. I was sad. I was hurt, you know, and I didn't do much. And then all of a sudden, folks got with me and they said, "Rick, you got to come out of this and, you know, do something with your life and that ordeal." And I said, "Let me get into coaching." So I coached high school. I coached college over at Tabor College over in Kansas, Thomas Jefferson High School there, right outside of Denver. Had a chance to coach there, then went down to Pueblo, Colorado. I was the head coach down there, and then ran a program down there called Rare Breed Sports and Leadership Programs, which were after school programs for kids and that whole deal. So, coaching was something, and working with young people was really what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Do you still run Rare Breed?
No, not at all. No. That was way back when.
All right. Now, I know back around 2010, 2011 timeframe, you started experiencing some health issues. What was going on with you at that time?
Well, I was down in Cape Coral, Florida. I was coaching down there, I wasn't feeling real good. I knew there were some things that were going on in that whole deal. And I thought, well, I had the flu or whatever. And so when I went to the doctor to get my examination in that whole deal, you know, they drew blood and, you know, all that, those type of things. And the next morning they called me and my wife and said they needed to see us in the office immediately. And so we went over to the office and the doctor says, "Well, your blood test didn't come back very good in that whole deal. We want to, you know, redo, you know, take some blood and redo it again." And so they did. They took some blood and they redid the testing again. And they called again early in the morning and said, "We need to see you in here immediately again." Mm. And so Donna and I got up and we went to the doctor and they says, "Well, we believe that you have, you know, cancer." I was like, "What?" You know, I'm like, "Oh, my goodness." And so what we want to do is send you to the Florida cancer specialist and so that we can verify it. And so what they did was they did a bone marrow biopsy there at the Florida cancer specialist. And when the readings came back, that's what they found out, that I had chronic myelogenous leukemia. And my numbers were getting ready. They were taking off. They were over the top. I was at over 200,000 white blood cell count in that whole deal. And that wasn't good. Yeah. And they accelerated within a week. So they put me on medication. I still take medication today because I'm a chronic case. And my wife, man, has been just by my side. She's been my champion, my rock. And I think football, man, prepared me for it. And, you know, I'm like, hey, it is what it is. Let's keep moving and grooving and not let it get us down and do what the doctors tell me to do. And I'm still here today.
Mm. Yeah. So you just mentioned it about football and how that's helped you. So talk to me about how your perspective on life has changed since getting that diagnosis and how football helped with your mindset.
I don't let a whole lot bother me anymore. I just don't. I don't think we have enough time to allow stupid things, man, to bother us and get us off of who we want to be and what we want to be. Strength wise, man, it mentally, I said to myself, I gotta play this out. And they told me you might not even get into remission for maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years, if any. And so just last year I was diagnosed as being in remission. So from 2011 to last year, I was still, you know, giving off bad numbers and that whole deal. I finally got, you know, to remission and that whole deal. But it was the waiting game. You know, you wait and you do whatever you got to do. Don't sit in a corner, man, just sitting around moping. Get up, be active, involve yourself with other things. That way it takes your mind off of what's going on with you. And the other thing I would do was go to Children's Hospital or to Ronald McDonald's hospitals in that whole deal. My wife and I would make blankets and give those things to the kids in that whole deal to uplift them as well. So you had to just do things, man, in order to take your mind off of what was going on.
So how are you feeling right now?
I feel fine. I feel great. I feel good. Still in remission, thank God. And I still get out, work with young people and tell them my story and I just let them know every day is not guaranteed to you.
Now, you were inducted into the Denver Broncos Ring of Honor. Talk to me about the experience of being immortalized by the Broncos.
Well, I, you know, again, it took so long, and that whole deal, I said to myself, why is it taking so long? And then after a while, I said to myself, whether I get in or not, that's left up to them. I can't run another punt back. I can't catch another pass, right? I can't, there's nothing else I can do. And, but, you know, I know what I contributed to our football team. And so when I was down in Cape Coral and had gotten that news, right? And then I get the news about going into the Broncos Ring of Fame. I was like, oh my God, God said, hey man, I got this for you. And so I was just elated. My wife was elated. My family, they were elated. They were just going nuts in that whole deal. And I said to myself, thank you, Father God. Thank you so very much. I appreciate you. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know when you retired, I think you were second all time in return yards, if I remember correctly. I think you're still.
No, I was number one.
You were number one. All right. Sorry.
I was number one. Yeah.
Dropped you down to two. Sorry about that.
I was the first player to go over 3,000 yards in the league. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And punt return yards and that whole deal. Mm-hmm. I was the first, very first. Hmm.
So why do you think you haven't received more traction for the Pro Football Hall of Fame?
Because they didn't know anything about us. Remember, we were in the Rocky Mountains, right? I mean, we hadn't won anything. You know, we didn't have the TV market or anything. So people didn't know us. East Coast, West Coast, Pittsburgh Steelers, Dallas Cowboys, right? All of those folks had all the media. And so just like with Randy Gradishar just getting in, you know, from that Orange Crush group, Louis Wright, an all-decade player, shutdown corner for us. You haven't heard much about him, but he was the first shutdown corner that the league had, for sure, outside of Willie Brown and those guys and that whole deal. So sitting there in the Rocky Mountains, I believe we got isolated, and they didn't know anything about us until 1977 when we went to the Super Bowl. Now everybody knows that Denver has a football team. Mm.
All right, I got a couple of questions that I normally like to ask my guests. So if you could live your life over again, what would you change?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, there's a lot of things that I would change. But the number one thing is just being able to spend more time with my family. Mm. That's it. Because, you know, family comes and goes. I just had to bury my oldest sister. Mm. You know, some of the ball players that I played with are no longer with us in that ordeal. So I just believe, you know, you live life and you live it to the full, right? Mm-hmm. And I would just want to live it to the full and spend more time with my family.
Okay. One final question. If you could go back and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
Always, man, listen to people who are wiser than you because they've already gone through the turmoils, the ups and the downs, and they can teach you a lot about what's going to happen if you do certain things and that ordeal. And I think listening to our elders and getting wisdom from them is huge. I think is massive. And so I would say paying attention to seniors and listening to them so that they can guide you through this world.
And it reminds me of the saying that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
That's that's for sure. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Rick, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so very much, Ken. You have a wonderful rest of your day and a great weekend.
You do the same. Thank you for listening to our interview with Rick Upchurch. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, a portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. Thank you for listening.
You did not see their faces on the Wheaties boxes, nor did they have the headlines, but they were breaking barriers, one pitch at a time. The integration of minor league baseball, a history and player register, 1946 to 1959, by Rick Swain and Gary C. Fink, shines a light on the overlooked heroes who paved the way for future legends. From dusty bus rides to hostile crowds, these players fought for a place in a game that did not want to see them win. More than history, it's a tribute to courage, perseverance, and the power of a game to change. Honor their legacy today and grab a copy of The Integration of Minor League Baseball at your favorite bookseller.